Sorry if I keep scratching my nose. My wife would kill me right now.
No, you're good.
She's like, get your hand away from your nose.
All right, I am here with Chris Carmichael. How are you, sir?
I'm well, sir. Thank you.
Where were you born?
I was born in San Antonio, Texas. The reason being my dad was an Air Force fighter pilot, so he was stationed at Lackland Air Force Base at the time. Well, that's where I was born. And we moved shortly thereafter to Wiesbaden, Germany. And I was still a baby, so I spent my very early formative toddler years in Germany, and we moved back to the States 3.5 years later or so to, again, back to San Antonio or that region, Universal City, Texas. He was stationed at Randolph Air Force Base.
Is that originally where your family is from?
No, my family is from Bowling Green.
Okay.
My dad was born in Bowling Green. My mom was the daughter of an itinerant minister. He was a Methodist minister, so they moved quite a bit in the Kentucky region. But my folks met when my grandfather had my mom's dad had a church here in Bowling Green, and they went to college high, you know, a couple years apart, and met, I think it's some kind of dance or something like that, but they went to Western around the same time and were kind of sweethearts and that, you know. So really, I consider Bowling Green to be my hometown, because when my dad retired from the Air Force after our moving around, you know, I lived in Virginia and for a while, and before he retired to Bowling Green in 75, and moved into what was his boyhood home.
Your mother or father, are they music?
My dad, music's always been in our family. My dad was very musical.
Okay.
I think he was sort of the product of a different generation. And my family at the time, they were all really kind of, you know, high-achieving lawyers and, you know, engineers, politicians, you know. On my dad's maternal grandmother's side, my grandfather, who moved to Bowling Green in the teens, was from Virginia, and so they were from the well-known Tucker family of Virginia, and so those roots were. You know, we have kind of deep Virginia roots that way, I suppose you might say.
What kind of music would you have been hearing at home when you were a child?
Oh, well, again, I was going to say my dad being the product of his environment and family situation was, despite having really what I consider to be an extreme musical gift, was not encouraged to pursue music as a career. And really, I do think he found his sort of bliss in flying jet aircraft and that, you know, and P-51s in Korea and everything, and when he flew combat in Vietnam. But having said that, I think if he would have had his choice, he probably would have pursued a musical career. He had that kind of ear, heard harmony deeply. Was played piano by ear, self-taught, prodigiously, really.
What kind of music was he into?
He was into jazz.
Jazz, okay.
Yeah, so when I grew up, it was all about, and then he was, you know, being of that kind of atomic age cocktails, you know.
Right, yeah.
I grew up, they were all at the house with the skinny ties and the tiki torches were going and the bongos, you know.
Right.
And so it was super cool, you know. Sure, I got to, I mostly was sequestered in a TV, you know, with a TV watching Bewitched or something, you know.
Yeah.
Then with a bowl of Doritos, and then I got to come out and make the appearance and, you know, shake a few hands and then off you go. And it would have been, you know, Jobim, things like that. My dad loved Burt Bacharach deeply, which was more pop, but with jazz sensibilities and that. He loved Glenn Miller. He loved all, but really he loved Dave Brubeck and so really that kind of a little bit more of that cocktail sound beyond the big band era was his groove. Right. So I grew up with all those, you know, great Klaus Ogerman arrangements playing in the background and Nelson Riddle and stuff like that, and I was just soaking it up like a sponge.
Right. So when do you remember the first time you played an instrument and what instrument was that?
Drums was my first instrument.
Okay.
And I just had to have a set of drums. I had two sets, both of which were destroyed by my brother's, you know, he was 10 years older. So they would take my drums, pound the heads out of them, you know, one day, and then go, hey, sorry, kid, you know.
Right. And how old were you when you started playing drums?
Five.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to this day, I think I love the drums. And you know, I love drummers, bass players. I think, you know, that's another thing. I think a frustrated bass player. I'm not really frustrated at anything. I play whatever. But I think that, you know, if I started a band from scratch today, I'd probably just pick the bass and play it. But somehow life was steering me toward the string family, you know? It's like beating the heads out of my drums. And
I was going to say, so you start playing drums. What'd you start playing after that?
There was always a keyboard around. There was shortly after, when we moved to Virginia, one day my mom just said, they offer violin lessons before school starts, and when I was in elementary school, and you're going to play. And I was like, no, I'm not going
not
to.
Not interested.
Uh-uh. And she was like, oh, yeah, we're gonna try it, you know. And so, man, they've outfitted me with a little violin, and I played it, and it just something clicked, you know. So I did not require any goading to practice and that kind of thing.
You actually enjoyed it.
I did, yeah. There was something kind of cool about it, and I don't know if it was just a tactile thing or whatever, but there was a connection there. And despite, you know, my adolescence and teen years when I sort of felt like I probably should have played the guitar or something like that because the violin was not, you know, high up on the chick factor or
not
whatever.
Maybe not the coolest thing for a
not
kid to play as far as girls are, yeah.
Yeah, but there, by the same token, having moved here when I was 13, I was, you know, the deck was sort of stacked against me anyway with respect to forming friends and
that kind
of
thing. You're the new kid and you play violin.
Yeah, so double, you know, that was three strikes even though it was only two factors, so... I think where it sort of turned around was when I finally brought my instrument the day of the talent contest. And, you know, I got laughed at all day long. And then the talent contest happened and I won it.
Right.
And, you know, against the rock bands, against, you know,
the
popular
school?
Kids. This was in junior high.
Junior high.
It was actually in the ninth grade. So that was at the old Bowling Green High School. Was the junior high, and I walked out on stage, and there was just nothing but uproarious laughter. And then I played, and immediately following was a deep silence, followed by a respectful applause.
Right.
And but then after I got my first prize, it was nothing but boos. And so,
what song? What did you play?
I played a piece called Allegro Brilliant by W. Tenhave. I don't know what the W stood for or whatever, but it was sort of that pre concerto repertoire uh-huh. that every kind of budding classical violinist has to play. There's certain through, yeah. student repertoire that shows that you're a burgeoning, prodigious soloist yeah. kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so it was heavily edited to fit the mandatory time frame. And man, I wore it out. And it worked. And then the next day, it was sort of that kind of, you know, I'd get these kind of, hey, man, that was pretty cool, you know.
Right.
You yeah. know, like.
Don't tell anybody, but I like violin. Making
sure nobody saw them, you know. And then it was sort of transformative and pivotal, really, because from the next year at the high school, which is where my daughter goes to school, she's graduating this year from, you know, cue theme song from Welcome Back, Kotter, and things started changing, you know, my relationships with people. And by the time I graduated from high school, I was cool with everyone, you know.
Right.
So the power of music, you know.
Right. And as far as, like, I guess, yeah, as far as high school, like you said, you didn't play guitar stuff, so you probably weren't in a garage band. But did you play with other people outside of school?
Yeah. And I did play in garage bands. And my brother and I played. We had a duo. And then I started playing with, in high school, my friend Bill Sacre, who was a really great guitar player. And we formed a duo. And just Sacre Carmichael. And, you know, he was 19. I was 17, you know, when I started doing my first club gigs in town. Right. Camelot Picking Parlor, which Bones Kalin owned. He was in the band The Tennessee Pulley Bone, which was on RCA, and he'd gotten off the road to kind of, you know, I think he probably started that place for the Pulley Bone to kind of have a place to play and just, you know, kind of a place to play when he was off the road. And our first date was, there were two opening acts, and we played first, and then there was a house band, Tommy Johnson's band, who I'm in a band with to this day. And and then Bonnie Bramlett of Delaney and Bonnie fame, you know, Eric Clapton and
sure.
She. So, I mean, those were exciting times for me, you know, opening up for Bonnie Bramlett and, right. you know, and just going like, well, I think I could do this, you know, I really dig this. We played all original music, Bill and I.
What did you play in that?
In that one, I played violin. But shortly after that period, I was in a band called The Times, and we were just like a rock band playing Ramones and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. You know? And so what did you play?
I was the lead singer. I played guitar, and Joe Cuhill was the lead guitarist of that band, and Mark Barnes was the drummer.
Where did The Times play?
Just all the pizza you can eat kind of, you know, gigs and right. somebody's backyard. And, you know, we had a practice facility. We mainly played in our practice facility, and then that was the place to hang out. And,
right.
Sneak beer in or whatever sure. it was. And or school dances. Or we played at the high school on stage and had a big concert there. And, you know, we had buttons. You know, buttons were the thing there. And so we got to do our best Sex Pistols impersonations. And
right.
Spit at the crowd.
But at that point, though, you're getting the kind of the opposite of what you were, you know, we were talking about. You were playing the violin. That wasn't the coolest, but now you're a lead singer.
Yeah, right. And and you know how it, then those, you know, those times in the bedroom where you're looking in the mirror and, you know, mouthing to your Who records and stuff like that, and then it all starts to, you know, take root and find an expression, I suppose you'd say.
Who would have been your favorite band?
At that time?
Mm-hmm.
I loved the Cars, you know. I thought they were great. Elvis Costello was huge for me. I loved Nick Lowe, you know.
And his, I love Nick Lowe.
Yeah. His bands, Brinsley Schwartz, and then a few years later, Rock Pile, you know, which I was a big Dave Edmunds fan too. And, you know, I probably found Nick Lowe, well, aside from the Brinsley Schwartz records, I don't think I'd made the connection that he had produced the first four Elvis Costello records, or at least the first, you know, couple. And then he was on my radar, you know. he had his own solo career at the time too. So then, you know, he was producing The Pretenders, you know, who I loved.
I think the first I remember is All Men Are Liars.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the first time I heard Nick Lowe.
Yeah. I think the first time he was on my, like, on my radio was probably Cruel to Be Kind, his hit, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. He was trying to break out into his own pop career or whatever. Right. And,
cool, man.
Yeah.
So what's after the Times?
Well, then that, Bill and I kind of reconnected again and started jamming with a band in town called Wind and Silver, which was Bobby Baldwin's band. Bobby is a well-known local guitarist. And, you know, and then, you know, you start to see the sort of incestuous cross-pollination of all these bands. We all played in each other's bands. And so,
exactly, yeah.
You know, Bobby was a really great player. Bill was a really great player. And Jeff Haar was the first drummer. We were friends, you know, Sacred and Jeff Haar and I. And Jeff is a name you may hear, you know, more than once in the course of your interviews. But he was a tremendous drummer. And but Jeff and Bill sort of felt like, well, this is kind of cool, but, you know, maybe we should do our own thing. You know, they had a few more designs. Bobby's music was a little more progressive, you know, so he was into those kind of 7-minute, 8-minute epic songs and stuff like that, which gave me a lot of opportunity to start stretching out. And I was playing electric violin and singing. So then I started using that band as a medium for my songs. And pretty soon we were an all original band. We'd sort of eschewed the 7-8 minute songs for, you know, our best minute 50s and right. that kind of thing. Or, you know, if we were indulgent, we'd stretch them out to 3 minutes or something like that. And really started crafting pop songs. And that's when I started my phase of wanting to be Benjamin Orr and Rick Ocasek, you know, kind of morphed into one entity. So who played an electric violin. And so we did local gigs in town all over the place. We gave a concert at the Capital Arts Center. We would do high school dances fairly regularly for Bowling Green Highs dances, Barnyard Boogies. We had a house gig at a place in town called Fontana's, which was also called the Down Under, I think, for a while. But you had to actually slide down a slide to get into the...
Really?
Yeah, to
Where
get
was
into
it at?
The venue. It was behind Kitchens Dotson. If you go down where Russellville Road is, the underpass is, close to Western, mm-hmm. right up on the hill up there, there was... there was a club, and so they served Italian food, and there was a KV dungeon bar down
in the belly.
Yeah, so you know, on any given night, you might see Sergeant Arms there, which was Bill Lloyd and David Surface's band, Mark Owens, who's the drummer of my band right now with Tommy Johnson, and Ernest Raymer, terrific local musician. That's another thing. While I was in college, Ernest and Jeff Smith and I, you know, you might know him as Smitty, who's the tech guy up at Western. He's also one of the most brilliant musicians I've ever had the pleasure of working with. But he just one day just was like, I'm kind of through with music. I'm just going to do this tech thing. And
right. And
really just does not do music now.
Doesn't care to do it at the moment.
Yeah, and I totally understand it. I mean, yeah. I really do. But... what a fantastic guitar player and just musician. We were at Western together. Long around this time, I'm also a music major at Western. So Jeff and I were in, you know, group piano together and that kind of thing. And then Jeff would say, hey, let's you and me and Ernie do jazz standards. Mm. We'll meet. And Ernest played flute and I would play violin and Jeff played guitar. So we'd do How High the Moon or, you know, Satin Doll or whatever right. kind of thing like that. And so...
So you graduate from Western?
I did not graduate.
But you did go for music theory or comp or just...
Violin performance.
Violin performance specifically, yeah. Okay.
I was, you know, I was composing music at, also at the time, but I was not a composition major.
Right.
Although I subsequently sort of filled in those cracks with my friend Doc Livingston, who kind of tucked me under his wing, and we would have little private get-togethers years later where he, you know, he assured me that I'd probably achieved more than a master's degree of composition learning by the time our little Wednesdays with Doc were over. And I don't doubt it.
What's the next thing you do?
Well, let's see. After Wind and Silver, I had made the decision along around this time that I was going to leave school. And I had taken on a summer job after my sophomore year at Western. And this was all much to my parents' chagrin.
I started to say, how did they feel about this?
They were not confident in my decision. And they were not near as confident in my decision as I was in my decision. And I was just working in a hospital kitchen, living in a place. I was probably working on my third apartment, you know, with friends and that kind of thing. I moved out when I was, you know, 18 and started my trek that way. And I was just working on the line of the kitchen one day, and somebody called and said, hey, telephone for you. I was like, okay. And went and answered, and it was Bones Kalin, whose name I had mentioned before, who had owned the Camelot Pick and Parlor. He remembered me. His dad owned Fontana's, and his dad for years had been going, man, you need to get this guy, Chris Carmichael. Well, Bones had formed a band with Tommy Johnson, and it was called the Dixie Line Band. And they were they were serious professional musicians. They were touring all over. They had just done an extended stay in Reno, and were back off the road. They had kind of, they'd been using a fiddle player, a well-known, actually husband and wife duo, Ron Tracy and Leslie Gould. But they were like, it's not quite what we're wanting to do. And so Bones contacted me and said, so how you fix for going on the road? And I was like, hey, I'm there, man, you know? And it's like, I'm thinking, I have to get an amp, you know? It's like, but I don't know how many times in my life somebody's going, how are you ready to do this? And I'm like, yes. And then I have to go home and figure out
how to happen. Make yourself ready. Yeah.
Yeah. I got home from work and they were already set up in my garage with their PA system. Well, actually, Wind and Silver was we used my garage as the practice facility. They had gone like, wow, man, this is great. They just hooked up all our stuff. And,
right.
And, you know, and I just remember that first rehearsal of all the guys walking in and going like, you know, taking their PA, and it's gradually it was like it was all gone by the end of the day. But not to fear, they just went into the back of their truck, you know, yeah, and just constructed their own PA. I learned 40 songs in 2 days, and I was in Grantville, Pennsylvania, doing a gig and making a salary.
In 2 days,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
40 songs in mm-hmm. 2 days. Yeah, you had to put some crunch time in there.
Yeah.
That's yeah. awesome. So you just what'd you tell the hospital, or did you
sayonara?
Did you quit or just not come back after that?
No, you know, I've never left a job on bad terms, really. With right. any. I mean, I was like, I'd like to provide you with more, you know, notice and that kind of thing, but you understand.
Yeah, I have to learn 40 songs and get to Pennsylvania
and start making some money. Yeah, right. And doing what I love. And they were right. like, hey, you know, dude, cool. You know.
And how old are you then?
20.
20. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I was playing illegally in, you know, in a club. You had to be 21, and
right.
and here I am, 20 years old, and I think that was January of 1983. So I was born July. I would have been 21.
Right. You know. You're not too far. You're not cheating it.
No,
too bad.
Not too bad. No, I figured I could probably fake this for a little while.
Right.
But we would off the road. We would play in town at places like the Eagles Club or the Knights Inn or Runway 5, and we were serious about. I mean, we did what we had to do in the way of supplementing our original music with David Allan Coe and, you know, kind of cooler country, Jerry Jeff Walker, the Amazing Rhythm Aces, stuff like that. And Towns Van Zandt and that kind of thing. So we were definitely headed in a certain direction. You know?
Right.
That really began my serious apprenticeship in songwriting. You know, we were regularly doing, showrooms. And so I was like, I mean, there was no better experience for me and my chops coming together and that kind of thing. It was definitely the gig where it all congealed, consolidated. And pretty soon I was a role player in my estimation. You know, I wasn't just kind of like, I was never at a loss for where I was going and what I wanted to play. And probably as a result of that gig. And I'm sure that the previous gig where I was doing a lot of soloing and stuff was helpful, but this was a whole nother, this was a whole nother deal.
I guess this also sounds like it kept you more honest too, meaning that this is what you do for a living now.
There was no faking it, baby.
Right.
You know? And so, and then when you were doing dates with, you know, occasional gigs with Newgrass Revival and, you know, John Hartford and Serious Pickers, then you knew that you were just going to, you couldn't have any holes in your, in your playing. You know, you had to be really playing, you know, and I do have to say that was a tremendous band vocally, the songwriting, tremendous steel guitar player, Tommy, you know, just a burning player. And this kid here, we did an original album recorded in Nashville, and we recorded in 83. It was released in 84. And so we sold it all over the country and t-shirts and toured the US and Canada. And we did that for a long time, you know.
What was the end of that?
Well, you know, we had achieved some interest, but it wasn't like, you know, they were beating down the doors for us. You know, for whatever reason, it was just, I think we were playing a type of music that we were terming Rastabilly at the time. And, and it was like a country reggae fusion. And you might say we were a bit ahead of the curve, you know, for those days.
Well, and that may be the first time I've ever heard Rastabilly.
Yeah.
So you were very ahead of the curve.
Yeah, and there was probably a little bit of a hot potato aspect to, you know, what we were doing. And for whatever reason, the band just kind of fell apart. Tommy and I decided to do just a rock band together. So enter, once again, Jeff Smith, Smitty, playing keyboards and bass, and Jeff Haar on drums. And Tommy and I and Tim Marshall on vocals, and the band was called The Screamers. And so we did, local appreciation fests and, you know, playing at the Tap Room, I think it was called the Tap Room at the time. And it was, once again, it was original material, but like Emerson, Lake and Palmer and, Led Zeppelin, that kind of stuff. And just stuff really that, I mean, it was just kind of a summer crazy experiment that we realized that those days were not going to be long for our survival, probably either in our health or our career musically.
Right.
And Jeff, we were doing a gig at Beach Bend. It was a big, I think Government Cheese was playing and, you know, some other bands and stuff. And Jeff dropped the bomb on us that he was going to be the lead singer for a metal band called TNA. And so we go on and do this gig, you know. Just having been informed of this, and we just wailed, man. There's some video footage out there. I'll have to send you a link at some point.
I'd like to see it.
I think of doing Black Dog and stuff like that. And that was the end of the Screamers. And shortly thereafter, I decided to kind of lay low for a little while. I was playing with a band called the Flying Monkeys. That was Larry Dillard, Jane Pearl, Bev Smith, Webb Hendricks on drums, Scott Brantley on guitar, percussion, John Dowell on bass, and they brought me in to just play. We were doing like Van Morrison and stuff like that. And once again, my chops were, by that time, they were there, and I was just wailing. And a guy from Nashville had heard about me. Actually, when I was playing with the Screamers, this woman had been telling him, you gotta go see this guy. He's up in Bowling Green. I was surveying at the time for a day gig with Jim Adams as a rodman chainman, just so I could, you know, pay my rent and that. And so I was doing a gig at the Kona Kai Lounge, and this guy walks in bald headed, and it was Joe Savage, and who was a really well known entertainer in Nashville and in the kind of the Silver Circuit. Vegas, Reno, Tahoe, Atlantic City, you know, we played everywhere. And so Joe comes in, and, you know, it's this, you know, looked like Mr. Clean, and like looked like a Zales had fallen on him, because it was just like, you know, he had rings on every finger and these gold chains, these just massive nuggets of gold everywhere. And the band is just like, we're playing, it's almost like, you know. And so Joe sits there front row, just like puts his pork pie hat, or no, actually it was like a Homburg, and just watches me intently like that. And so we end our set, and he just goes, he's this Italian guy, and he's like, he talks like this, just like, so have you ever flown? And I'm thinking, do you mean some kind of like psychedelic experience? I mean, what are you talking about? You know, right. He's like, and I'm like, exactly what do you mean? He goes, like on stage. I was like, yeah, I like to feel like my music transformed me. He goes, no, I mean like on a wire. I was like, no, I've never done that. He's like, yeah. Okay, well, you're going to. I was like, hey, I am in. It's like, we start in Orlando at JJ Whispers, this new club opening up, and we're going to be playing in the showroom. It was like they were trying to recreate this kind of Ricky Ricardo, yeah. Dinner, you know, like Babalu and all that, but it was just with Joe Savage, who was really a phenomenal entertainer. Mm. He was famous for using like snakes, Burmese pythons, 2-3 strapped on them at a time. I'm talking 18 foot long ones.
Wow.
Famous for leopards in cages or leopards on stage. Actually, tragically, while we were playing in Lake Tahoe, one of the leopards got out and killed his baby girl. And oh, wow. We were in Las Vegas when that happened. Playing at the Silver Slipper, which is no longer there, but it was kind of a national incident, you know, when that happened. It was a big sort of media event. That was a whole nother, by that time I was going out, I was playing in all these great showrooms all over.
And are you flying?
Oh yeah, I'm doing everything, man. Yeah, I was.
How was that the first time?
It was an experience, yeah. It was just circus glitz and glam but the players were unbelievable. Joe was famous for always having the best musicians, and so we played everything from Sinatra to Judas Priest, and all convincingly. In fact, we played for Sinatra one night. He came to see us play.
Oh wow.
Mm-hmm. He and Tina and his manager, Jilly Rizzo. And so, I got to play for Jean-Luc Ponty, who was one of my heroes growing up. He came to see me play.
Wow.
And we were playing one of his songs, as a matter of fact. And I got to open the shows with my songs or instrumentals or whatever kind of thing. Had a spot featured in the middle and, you know, that kind of thing. In addition to sometimes... Well, more often than not, if I wasn't soloing, I was kind of the third horn of the band. So there was a sax, trumpet, and then,
In harmony with them.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what a tremendous experience. But through that, once again, I was making all these connections. I met Jason D. Williams in Lake Tahoe, who was on RCA at the time. We became, actually his manager, Roy Day, saw me. And by the time the Joe Savage thing had worked out, I had decided I'd move to Nashville, and Roy found me. And then next thing I know, I was doing, major TV shows with Jason. There's a thing on the internet, on YouTube, of the Pat Sajak show. If you can look up Jason D. Williams and Chris Carmichael. Sometimes my hair is down to here. About this same time, I had been playing in Nashville. When you're in Nashville, you're doing everything, especially when you're new to Nashville. So I was, I was playing with whoever. Matresa Berg and I were doing things together, writing and doing shows. I'd met through her husband, Chuck Cannon, who was Laurie White's husband most recently. Laurie just passed from cancer, sadly, who I worked with on a number of really great records, but he and Matresa had just divorced, and Chuck was like, man, I got to get you guys together. She had just signed with RCA. So I was doing a lot of these RCA kind of acts. Jason was crazy. He's purported to be the illegitimate son of Jerry Lee Lewis. But he did the hand close-ups in Great Balls of Fire, Dennis Quaid's.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we were doing, MTV, the Lone Star in New York, or, all these great CBGBs, places I'd always wanted to play.
Right.
Yeah. So that was another one I got to mark off my bucket list. I was like, oh, I did the Palomino, and, I was playing all these kind of famous places. But I was playing with Anthony Crawford and Keith Christopher. Anthony is now in a band with Will Kimbrough called Willie Sugar Caps. And Keith Christopher he founded the Georgia Satellites. He left them to go play with Humble Pie, and which ended up not being the best career move, because it was shortly thereafter that, Keep Your Hands to Yourself came out, and, it was just like, oh, wow, I probably should. In fact, it was called Keith and the Satellites. Okay. And so then they had to change the name. And so Anthony, Keith, and I, and Scott Brantley, who had been in the Wild Indians, and Wayne Killius had a band called the Wild Indians. And about that time, I'm doing these, I was playing with Jason, doing whatever I could do just to kind of make the money I could make. These guys from a metal band called Hocus Pocus, and then they had another band called Lust, came with the concept. They'd seen me with Joe. They said, look, two rock and heavy metal guitars, you're the lead vocalist, electric violin, we know you write songs, right. And then the next thing you know, we had formed this band called 15 Strings. And in a year's time, we were signed to Atlantic Records in New York. We practiced every night. They were in Murfreesboro. I'm in Bellevue, Tennessee. And so the drummer, Matt Green, would come. He worked at Forks Drum Closet. And when that was closed, he would come pick me up. I didn't even have a car at the time. I was walking to work. I was working in a Kroger video center.
Right. How old are you at this time?
I think I'm like 27 by this time.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, roughly 27.
Right, and we kind of skimmed over it too. But I mean, would that have been the first time you properly signed to
a major label?
To a major label. What was the feeling at the time? Did you get the feeling that you expect to get, like, I've made it, or was it just like, this is another step?
You know, you're always so guarded in the music. I mean, yeah, on some level I thought, well, I have done this. I can say that I've done this. It has happened. The ink is dry. But you also, I mean, we signed an 8-album deal, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, but I never at any time thought I'm going to have 8 records in the marketplace on with this band.
Right.
And because those 8-album deals are always at their pleasure.
Yeah.
And so, and they always retain that option to, and the reality of the situation was we had hit the sort of fallen in, you know, it's like the Indiana Jones Temple of Doom door was going, and we had just slid under the door in that world. They fancied us as being part of their metal department.
Right.
And I have a thing at home, Billboard. It's like, we're working hard to turn our metal into gold. And it's like 15 strings, Rush, AC/DC, you know, and I'm like, now when you see something like that in Billboard magazine, you think, "Who? Okay, going to pinch myself."
Right. Yeah.
You're recording. You're hemorrhaging hundreds of thousands of dollars of label money, making a record in New York, and so you're living these sort of out of body experiences. But at the same time, you're like, until I see it on the shelf, I am not going to allow myself to feel good about this. You know. Right. And in reality, it was a good thing because the winds of change were blowing. And the reality was, we knew even at the time, the label heads, I mean, I was hanging out with Ahmed Erdogan and, you know, all kinds of other kind of like, okay, pinch me again. Right. Wait, there's no skin left.
Right.
The grunge thing was happening. And they were like, you know, these bands' names started coming in, like Stone Temple Pilots, and they were, oh, that's Mudhoney, we got to go see them, you know? And
right.
And you're thinking, like, ooh. And then you hear, like, oh, Badlands has been axed. And, you know, and we're going, like, oh,
starting to look okay, a little bad. Yeah. Right?
And so they were, like, trying to be resourceful, going, like, what do you guys feel about grunge music? You know, like, because we haven't quite released this yet, and we don't want to. And unfortunately, we were so invested in, you know, we had a record in the can. They kept under the guise of that first single, you know, we're still kind of looking for that first mm-hmm. single. And keep writing, you know, I mean, and listen to this, you know, it's like, oh, that's kind of like Nirvana, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
And
that's not quite what we've been doing.
What we've been doing. And so I went up on one trip. I was riding with my. I had been signed. We had been signed as a band to Warner Chappell after the signing of our record deal. And but I was the main writer of the band, so they were trying to get me to write with other writers. I finally went up, and I just asked Jason Flom, my A&R guy. I was like, I think I really would like my life back. And you know, he was like, okay, then, that's what we'll do, you know. And I promptly walked upstairs and, you know, I told my publisher that this might be happening. And they said, okay, well, here's what we're going to do. We're signing you as a staff writer and we're signing you.
Just you.
So I came back with all kinds of bad news for my band. And unfortunately, I mean, it was easy to tell that. Now, I did go up with the green light to say if this wasn't the single, then ask him out. I did, but I was not expecting my publisher, Kenny McPherson, to say, well, here's what we'd like to do.
Right.
In light of this information, we want to sign you as a staff writer, and which would mean that we would be dropping the entity of 15 strings and we'll start you on salary and here's what you'll be making. And I went like, yes, I can do that. You know,
wasn't a hard decision
for me. And was hard for me to go back and go, okay, guys.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That.
And I was not Mr. Popularity. And, that was unfortunately, you know, the other choice was to go like, no, we're doing the metal thing because we're 15 strings. And, you know, it's just like, no, you just got to wake up and smell the coffee. And I was sort of hoping that, you know, everyone would kind of understand that. The band, I was just like, I'm done. If this isn't it, then
we don't
we've given it the best ride we can give it. And So I did that, you know, for another 3 years. I was signed as a staff writer. I lived in Nashville, but I was signed out of New York. And so, which was interesting because I was always going to New York or Los Angeles, writing with guys in Nashville, great writers.
And as I was going to say, as a staff writer, that's you're just writing material?
Mm-hmm. You know, I was responsible for 8 100% written songs in a year. And or any mathematical equation, you know,
as long as it
16
added up.
Co-writes or you yeah. know, whatever, you know.
Now, with that being your job, I'm assuming, I mean, it's not like a desk job.
No.
Is it just you turn in what you have, or are you constantly checking in? And they're like, how about you talk to this person? How
you know,
how much are they in your business at that point? I guess is what I'm saying.
Probably not enough for okay. me, you know, because I was like playing golf.
Right.
You know, and just doing what, and I'm not saying I wasn't doing my job. But I am saying that I did take advantage of my freedom and I didn't abuse it, but I wasn't like, just like, I wasn't this typical kind of Nashville songwriter. In fact, I kind of enjoyed being the resident rock writer because mm-hmm. it was a little bit more freedom and leeway as opposed to the guys that would, I mean, that was their thing. I still had very long hair, and I wasn't like the guy who came in with his shirt tucked in and, you know,
yeah.
kind of thing. And although, I mean, I didn't have an attitude about those guys or whatever, and some of them... to this day, I have great relationships with some of those guys. But I was expected to kind of be a little edgier and that kind of thing. Well, but
what would you pick from that time frame to be the one of your songs that you're most proud of during those 3 years?
Here's the hard part for me is that I was always looking at a way to turn this, to salvage this into another artist deal.
Right.
So I wasn't necessarily, I was writing with really great writers like Robert White Johnson and Taylor Rhodes, you know, who wrote like Where Does My Heart Beat Now for Celine Dion and Bill Como wrote O'Sherry, co-wrote O'Sherry. And we teamed up, we actually teamed up and made a record of my stuff. So the downside was I wasn't like, trying to write for cuts. I was writing for my next deal.
Right.
And so I wasn't actively going like, hey, push this song or whatever. I was, or now if there was an opportunity for one of my songs to do something cool, in fact, one of them, a song I wrote with Bill Como and Robert White Johnson and Nick Nguyen from the band Bone Pony. Actually, Nick and I started out with the song, and then I brought the other guys in on it. Oh, actually, it was just Robert. Bill played on it, and Richard Dodd engineered it, who Traveling Wilburys and Tom Petty and George Harrison fame and mm-hmm. Jeff Lynne. And I was told that, the director of the movie came in. The movie was Mrs. Doubtfire. And my song was going to be the song. It was called Something in Common. And I was singing it. I was the artist. And they were like, this is how we're going to launch you, your solo career, the uh-huh. whole thing. And the director, Christopher Columbus, decides at the very... I mean, we had popped the corks. The music director was like, dude, this is it. This is it. And we were like, boom, high fives all yeah. around. And at the last minute, he decides... Dude Looks Like a Lady is going to be it. And, which was a little on the nose.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like this, my song was more about like, we've got something in common, you know, and it was the kids, and it was actually told the story. They were like, I can't believe how this lines up with in the track. And, so I had a few experiences like that were just, what are you trying to tell me up there? Why is this, you know, why?
Right.
The dangling carrot is, I can taste it. It's the molecules are in my mouth.
Can't quite eat it yet. Yeah.
And, you know, oh, for a set of guinea pig teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But, in retrospect, I understand completely why, you know, because all the while I'm doing this, I'm crafting arrangements for myself. I didn't have like tons and tons of instruments at the time like I do now, because I wasn't in my trade. My trade was something else at that time, but I'm writing these arrangements for myself and crafting them in the studio, and pretty soon people are going, dude, Charlie Midnight once told me, he was like, dude, we were writing together. He goes, I really envy you. I'm like, why do you envy me? You know, he said, because if the bottom ever falls out, you have a trade. and so those words, it's like trade, mm-hmm. trade. You know, they stayed in the back of my head, and I'm starting to go like, you know, I probably could do that. People were going like, could you do that on my record? You know, I was like, sure, yeah, you know. And so more and more studio work started coming in as a result, and I'm transitioning into this less me, more service to others kind of thing. And pretty soon I'm working on, you know, big time major label records, and I'm like, making money, that was another factor. One day I went out to the mailbox and my check wasn't there, and I called up Warner Chappell. I was like, hey guys, just want to let you know the check's not there. And they were like, right. We're well aware of that. You know, yeah. It's like, okay, just making sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking, well, I guess we're on to the next phase of our career here. And now I understand. When I went like, what are you trying to tell me? It was like, this is the universe said, this is what we're trying to tell you. Yeah. Don't be the guy with long hair crawling on his belly like a reptile, because no one will ever trust you with their record.
Right.
You know, it's like if Sebastian Bach had really been a great string arranger, they'd go like, no, that's just a long-haired bonehead, you know. I need Nelson Riddle to come in and work on this record, you know. So really, ultimately, the best thing that ever happened to me was what did not, you know.
Right. That's cool, man. Yeah. And you're basically still doing the same thing.
That's what I do.
To this very
day. I understand now. Why, I mean, I kind of tried to take it on faith, but I wasn't sure while these setbacks were happening. And
yeah.
And but I totally, I mean, I am doing what I love, you know, every day now. I mean, I work on so many different kinds of great records, you know.
And you're getting the whole spectrum now, too, which yeah. I guess would be
yeah.
one plus as opposed to if you had been in a band that took off, you would have had that one style of music. Now you have everything.
All of it. I play on every yeah. kind of music, so I'm just it's just a tossed salad of awesomeness.
Right.
And I get to do it in my home.
Right.
You know, so it's just like,
that's
what percentile of musicians do that? You know,
right.
It's like I now I get it. You know, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm so happy. I wasn't that guy on, you know, a face.
Right.
Right. Yeah. My friend Cactus Mosier, who was in the band Highway 101, who's now Wynonna's husband, he plays in her band now or whatever, but he's done a lot of cool things. But he told me that, you know, he was a fantastic musician. We were in a band for a while called Kaylee Rain. And he said, you know, no one calls me for their records. He said, because I was a face. Note to self, being a face is not necessarily good.
Right. So, doesn't always work out.
Yeah. And so I probably wouldn't have minded it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like there is that sort of unfortunate aspect. Some guys can get away with it, you know. I'm sure there are guys that have parlayed successful careers, you know, like Mark Mothersbaugh and guys like that who now are, you know, film composers and things like that that were in bands and kind of things like that, but not a whole lot, you know. Mm. Yeah, I think you have to have those skill sets anyway, and so that's not always the case either for frontmen of bands to
right.
also be composers and, you know.
Yeah, a lot of times it's just a face that's required.
Yeah.
In certain circumstances.
And a lot of energy.
Sure.
Yeah, he's got a lot of energy.
Move around, look good. 1, 2, 3, go.
Yeah, right. Somehow not translating on the record. So.
That is awesome, man. Out of curiosity, if you're asked to be on someone's project, is it typically a timeline that you give them, or do they give you a timeline?
It's both. You know, they'll go like, "What are your avails?" And
I guess depending on the client.
Well, that's true too. It's like, guess who just got bumped to the top of the line? You know, it's like,
right?
You know, Sheryl Crow calls up, then I'm like, I think I got some wiggle room, you know, or something like that. But I, you know, not that I'm honest about it. I mean, if I have a hard deadline or something like that, I'll just say, I'll have to let the chips fall where they may. I'm like, look, I'm booked at this time or whatever like that. Do I have some room on your end? Or I can just say no, you know, I've had to do that before.
And we kind of hit on it before we started recording, but if you could go back and tell yourself in the quote younger days when you first started playing music, what would be the best advice you think you could have heard? What took you a while to learn that you wish you had gotten right?
Well, I think I've been incredibly lucky in many respects, you know. I can't say that I would have changed one single thing. I really don't think I see it all as having been about as good as it could have worked out for me.
That's awesome.
So I don't think I would have, and I don't see that out of any kind of disingenuous place. I think that I'm really glad the way things worked out. And I don't think I think if I would have changed one thing, it's sort of like that, It's a Wonderful Life thing, you know, it's sure. like, you know, one factor can change things.
Everything,
yeah. And so, being very
necessary evil, necessary good to get you where you are now.
Yeah. Being very content with where I am, you know, and now maybe looking forward is something that, you know, sometimes I get the feeling like, should I be pushing myself to achieve some other kind of thing?
Right.
You know, I'm almost too content with everything being on the come and just sort of falling, sifting into place and always having this steady diet of interesting stuff, you know, it's right. always interesting, but I'm thinking like, do I, you know, I guess it beats jumping on a tour bus unless you're into that. And sure. I enjoyed that too. Yeah. I did that, you know, and I can't say as I miss that any of it is as nice as a lot of that was.
Yeah.
But maybe looking forward, I'm trying to challenge myself with, is there a level of pain that I should be taking on right now to, in the interest of the tertiary period of my career, which I feel like I'm now encroaching?
Sure.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Best song of all time.
Ah.
Come clean.
Boy. Well, I would have to give you a handful.
I'll take three.
Okay. I would say Wichita Lineman is in there. Probably of Al DeLore's arrangement. So I don't know why. I mean, that's just one of those guiding stars for me. You know, Ode to Billy Joe is pretty great. Again, for the same reason. And now you see where I'm kind of, all of these songs have strings in them, you know, for me. Right. So maybe I'm a bit myopic with respect to.
Well, let me ask you this then. Your favorite band?
Another toughie. You know what? I don't know why I'm going to say this, but it might be just an artist thing or whatever. Maybe Nick Drake.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, because I think there's never a time when I could put his music on, like Way to Blue, for example, which is just kind of a greatest hits assemblage or whatever like that. That, you know, what a tragic kind of life he had. And I don't know why I'm sort of drawn to saying that, or I would just say that, but I guess that there's just a lot in there for me, and there's simplicity, but there's also complexity.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. It's easier for me to say a composer or something like that, although even that's tough for me, but it still comes down to Bach or Beethoven, you know, usually, or something like that. But
who's your favorite film composer? Like people that are known for just doing film comp?
Maybe Howard Shore.
Okay.
I appreciate maybe Elmer Bernstein. There's so many other, you know, Hans Zimmer is just he's a favorite of many. He's not one of my favorites.
He's like going out with bands, like doing full shows now at festivals and stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate his work very much, but for what I like, even Leonard Bernstein wrote some, On the Waterfront themes. His work in that is pretty fantastic.
Right.
So I guess, but he's not voluminous in that way in film. So it's just tough to say. I don't know.
If you think of it, get back with me.
Okay, I will.
And I guess I should like to end up here. Thank you again very much for your time.
Oh, man, my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
And what advice do you have for a starting musician in any format?
Well, I say this not even in tongue in cheek, and it's probably a cop out, but just probably pack a lunch, you know? And, 'cause really, I mean, I guess outside of that, it would be like, be sure and make lots of mistakes. And that usually means just keep trying.
Just keep going.
Yeah.
Right.
So, because if you're resourceful, you're learning from your mistakes, and they're not all successes. I had tons and tons of no's, tons and tons of setbacks, tons and tons of hard times, uncertainty, self-doubt. It is not for the faint of heart. And so I suppose really my first advice, pack a lunch.